Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
That is the King Lion Players, actually from Soweto, South Africa. And that is One by One, part of the Lion King program.
And a very appropriate piece of music for tonight.
Very appropriate piece of music tonight. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Jim. How are you doing, sir?
And I'm doing well. And Bobby Jean, I trust that you're just suffering along with the rest of us.
That was a great piece of music.
You know, it took me a couple hours to actually find that piece of music yesterday, because I was looking so hard to find, you know, some of the, like the Zulu, the mm-hmm. with the chanting, and I couldn't find it. And the bookie finally said, go to the Lion King. Well, I did, and then I found the Soweto, the Lion King Players, which are from Soweto, and which, of course, is mentioned in the book, the Soweto Uprising mm-hmm. and stuff. So it was just absolutely perfect. So it was going to be that or the lion sleeps tonight. And wasn't going to work for me.
Option A worked better.
It did. So anyway, hi, gang. I hope everybody's in good health. And have you got snow, Bobby Jean?
We had a little dusting of snow one morning last week, but today was back to just California blue sky, mild temps. Yeah, if I didn't know better and I looked out my window, I think I was still in California many days.
Well, you're not. You're in New Mexico, and we're in California, and we're going to get New Mexico weather tonight.
Yes,
and
we are.
All the way actually through next week.
Oh, you are?
Oh, we are. Yeah, we're looking at it. I have to go to Lake Isabella on Saturday, and it's supposed to be snowing up over Bakersfield. And
oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'll be in my bed. You have a nice trip.
Yeah, I will. Well, Richard, let's get this ball rolling.
Definitely. Well, congratulations, my young first-time author. You have finally typed those two wonderful words, the end, on your book. You think the hard work is over. You are wrong. It is just starting.
Sadly mistaken.
You are going to have that thing edited. You need it formatted, and you need to create yourself a cover, all in preparation for release day. And that's not even the hard part. Now comes the marketing, and that's even harder. But if you think that sounds like too much work, the people at Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books are here to help you out. They will do all the heavy lifting for you so you can get paid for your work and do the most important thing, which is getting back to work writing. Find out more about their program, including access to an editor and a cover artist at a reduced cost. Give them a call at 805-795-3165 or email them at J, the letter, not the name, jchristina@tuscanybaybooks.com. Or you can torture yourself and go rpolinelli@tuscanybaybooks.com, and we'll tell you everything you need to know to get published.
And if you email J. Christina, I'll tell you how to spell R. Polinelli, and then you can probably email him, too.
Yeah, you can email me.
Or you can go to TuscanyBayBooks.com, or you can go to BlackDogPublishing.co.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and out west, this is Out West Shop is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and Western lifestyles. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, fashion accessories, home decor, and general merchandise. National brands include Rockmount Ranchwear, Scully Leather Company, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Shop online at www.outwestshops.com, shop.com, or SCV Out West still is viable. Is it not, Bobby Jean?
It sure is.
Okay, scvoutwest.com. Enter code WB100 and receive $10 off your order. Or you can call them toll-free at 877-340-9378.
Hey, Bobby Jean, do I want a black hat or a white hat for the Cowboy Festival?
Do you want Dust to show up on it, or do you want to still look like the good guy at the end of the day?
Not with my reputation.
There's no way you can look like a good guy.
We'll go the Dust route. We're talking black hat here, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll be the cute looking guy with the black hat on.
There you go. Okay. enough
for there'll just be a few of those at the festival.
Correct.
You'll blend right in.
One or two. Yeah.
Since 2009, guys, if you're listening, Target Freight has had a full truckload service, TFM truckload, and an LTL service that are the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they work hard to make sure your full truckload shipping or LTL experience is unparalleled using their customized traffic movement program. So call TFM Truckload or Target Freight Management LTL today. TFM Truckload is 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski for Truckload or any of the fine account managers at 888-653-1323 for LTL. Tell them you heard it on the Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. Or if you prefer, you can go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Okay, that's out of the way. Let's do a little bit of bio here. Short bio. Our guest tonight holds a certificate in creative writing from the University of Toronto's SCS, and her work has been published in World Enough and Crime. Before turning to writing, she started a corporate training company and volunteered with Cotlands, where she assisted care workers in Soweto with providing aid for HIV and AIDS orphans. Originally from South Africa, she now resides in Toronto with her husband, and I believe I read someplace else, a deranged dog, if I'm not mistaken. So would you please, without any further ado, welcome writer Bianca Murray to the Writer's Block.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you don't know how big of an honor this is, actually, Bianca. It was. I got a hold of your books. I hurriedly sent them out to everybody last week, and we all just went on a reading jag this week, getting through your book. And personally, this is my opinion. I found this story absolutely captivating. I believe I told you that the other night on the phone. Yes. It really, truly is. And we're going to be talking a little bit about your book tonight and about you and your, not so much your personal life, but your process in getting the book written and just all kinds of stuff. We will not be asking you any personal questions. Well,
oh,
Richard
dude.
May.
Hey, now. You know, you do it one time.
I know. Reputation. One time, you know. Yeah. Anyway, other than what's in your bio, Bianca, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? I know you were born in South Africa.
Yeah.
Can we take it from there?
Yeah, born and raised in South Africa. And then 5 years ago, my husband and I, in 2012, decided that we were bored and we would like to pack up our entire lives and move across the world to a city that we'd never visited, in a country we'd never been in, and where we didn't know absolutely anybody. And that's how we ended up in Toronto with 4 suitcases and as many pets. And that's what we did, and it just worked out brilliantly. We absolutely loved it. I think the most interesting thing about me is that I was once bitten by a giraffe.
Yeah. Did you just say you were bitten by a giraffe?
Yeah, once bitten by a giraffe.
Uh-huh.
And they bite quite hard, I can tell you that. I still have the scar to prove it, and that's about the most interesting thing about me.
Well, I think that qualifies as interesting.
Well,
yeah.
Now, I have to ask, because, of course, I'm the sick one in this program. Are you one of those people that walks up to the fence where it says, don't put your hand in the fence, and you stuck your hand in the fence?
Yes, I absolutely am, but that's not why I was bitten by the giraffe. It was actually one of these, you know, the rest of the world has petting zoos.
Sure.
South Africa has places where you can, you know, interact very closely with these big wild animals. And it was my godchild's first birthday party, and we had these pellets, because that's what you feed giraffes, apparently, pellets. made from trees. And I was up on the platform holding out this pellet to this giraffe, but I apparently didn't let it go quickly enough. And I don't know if you realize, but giraffes have got really, really long black tongues. And it wrapped it around my hand, and I pulled it in, and I got such a fright. And then, of course, it bit me to make me let go of the treat. And with a bunch of one-year-olds around me, I couldn't scream and swear and whatever like I wanted to. So I just had to smile and nod through the pain of it so that I didn't scare the crap out of the kids. But, yeah, it was a learning experience. I won't do that again.
Oh, I would have gone ahead and sworn and screamed and then would apologize later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then
yeah, yeah.
And then... And then you'd put it in a book, Jim.
Of course I would.
Well, yeah.
You know me too well, Bobby Jean.
Where do you think we get half of our ideas from? You know? Stupid stuff we've done in our lives. There you go.
Well, yeah. You wrote a book called Hum If You Don't Know the Words.
Yes.
And it is, I'm not giving away anything in the book. This was published in 2017, am I correct, Bianca?
Yes.
Okay.
July of last year.
Okay. Not giving away anything, any spoiler alerts or anything, but the story is of a 9-year-old. She's nine. Her name is Robin. Her parents and she are from South Africa in Johannesburg. And as events go, it leads up to the Soweto uprising and the riot. And then beyond that, it goes into the following year of everything that happened to Robin past the Soweto uprising. Did that pretty much cover it?
Yeah, well, that covers Robin's story. You know,
right.
the better character for me
was
Beauty. Yeah, the black woman whose daughter goes missing as well. Yeah.
Phenomenal character, incidentally. Beauty is like, she was one of my favorites.
She's remarkable.
Remarkable woman.
She was just an amazing character to write, yeah.
It was somebody you knew?
Well, it wasn't somebody I knew, but it was definitely inspired by somebody I knew. So, you know, I was one of these white kids who was raised in apartheid. And so we had a black maid work for our family because that's what happened in South Africa at that time. Her name was Eunice. And, you know, she helped raise me from before I was born, and I absolutely adored her. And it was my relationship with her that inspired the character of Beauty, although, you know, the plot's entirely fictional, mm-hmm. and Beauty's life story was very different,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did Mabel have anything to do with your character, Mabel, with that as well, or is that a combination of
both?
Well,
yeah, you know what, Mabel was actually, the maid in the beginning is actually how Eunice was, because Eunice was deprived of a proper education due to the Bantu Education Act, so she only managed to study up until a grade 6. So she wasn't properly educated, and she worked as a maid from a young age. So the character of Mabel was pretty much how Eunice was, but Beauty was how I imagined Eunice's life to be if she'd been allowed to get an education and if she'd managed to study as a teacher, which she told me was always her dream. So she didn't have this life, and I wanted to give her this life, even if it was through a fictional character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly enjoyed all of your characters, not just, I mean, and her aunt. Her aunt is, I'm not too sure I even liked her aunt a whole lot. Edith, I'm not too sure I liked her, but.
I loved Edith. You know, she's like a bit of an alcoholic, and she's the free spirit and doesn't want to raise a child. And it's quite funny because, you know, when you meet readers, one of the first questions they always have is, oh, which character is you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they always ask, is it Robin, is it Beauty? And if I'm honest, I go, well, it's Edith. And, of course, that's the character most readers hate because they see her as this very selfish, obnoxious character. And I'm going, well, that's the one who's most like me, you know? So I thoroughly enjoyed writing Edith. She was just this character that was so true to herself, and she lived beyond the convention of her times. And in all honesty, my secondary characters generally are the ones that I love the most, and they end up taking over the whole story, which is, of course, always painful. So you have to, like, beat them back with a stick and get them to behave themselves.
Right, right, right. And I hate it when they take over a story or take a life of their own, and they're not doing anything you write them to do. They want to do their own stuff.
And well, exactly. And yeah. I mean, the same thing happened to me with a parrot. I mean, the parrot called Elvis.
I loved Elvis.
I loved Elvis.
Well, I mean, this is talking African gray parrot, and there he is taking over the whole story, you know. And I never even had a parrot as a child. I've never had a bird in my life. I had to research what they were, what they like, but this bird just landed on my shoulder fully formed, and he refused to go away. So there he is in the story.
Oh, mm-hmm. My God. He was absolutely one. Some of the funniest episodes in that book were Elvis.
Well, he always had the perfect put down when it was needed. He could
sing
somebody. What are you going to do, slap a bird?
And I have to tell you, Bianca, one of the best scenes in the whole book is when Edith comes home and she's very upset. And Robin says, what's the matter? She goes, Elvis died.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, no, I just put him back in his cage. He's fine. No, the real Elvis. No, he's in his cage. No, the real Elvis, the king.
Yeah. She's completely obsessed with him. And I think it was the fact that I had an aunt when I was growing up, and she was obsessed with Elvis. You know, because too young for the whole Elvis craze.
Oh, sure.
But she loved him, and she had this whole scrapbook full of Elvis stories. And she was devastated when he died. So I think, you know, that's what inspired that whole episode.
Well, and then, of course, the character Beauty has no idea who he is and doesn't understand. Yeah. And Robin doesn't really know exactly. And I think that's all really important, because Edith is our gal that travels the world as a airline stewardess, or whatever the proper term was at that time, hostess. And so she's able to see that larger world, and she has really interesting friends. You write a wonderful Christmas day.
Oh, my God, yes.
And we've got Robin in hot pants, you know, and a beautiful day with Victor and his friends. And these are all folks that know Edith. And she just has this, I think because she's not grounded in home. She's out and about. And so she's able to bring that outside look at the bigger world into this plot.
Yeah, very insular kind of society.
Right.
You know, and that was important to me, because South Africa at that time was just so far removed from the rest of the world. There were sanctions against it. Television only became available in 1976. So, you know, it was really separated from the rest of the world. And I needed this character of Edith, who was so cosmopolitan, who was so beyond her time, who had homosexual friends, who saw beyond race. And she was necessary to be able to expand Robin's worldview, because Robin initially grew up in this little mining town, you know, full of these racists and this very insular us and them kind of worldview. And that's why Edith was so lovely, because she saw beyond all of that and didn't allow any of that to constrain her.
Right, right. And as the story progresses, she becomes less and less and less. She becomes more free-spirited and more accepting of the black families and the Indian families. So I loved it. I loved the whole premise of the book. I did.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you for writing it, because it you swung me over.
It was a necessary book for me to write. It was something that I'd wanted to write forever. I'd had it at the back of my mind for many years while I was growing up.
Sure.
But I put off writing it. Like, until I wrote this book, I'd focused on very, very funny sort of slapstick kind of Terry Pratchett ripoff novels. And I think I did that because I knew writing this book was going to break me a little, and so I tiptoed around it. And it was only once I left South Africa that I was able to come back to it and be able to sit down and write it.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the move to Toronto, in a way, did it kind of free you up to be able to write it? Not being in South Africa.
Yeah, as you know, as writers, there's moments in our lives that just stick with us and either traumatize us or shape who we are.
Uh-huh.
And there aren't always things that we can verbalize at the time. You know, you need time to pass. You need to be able to look back on it to be able to see it objectively and for what it was. And for me, it was leaving South Africa, because that gave me emotional and physical distance. And also arriving in a city like Toronto. I mean, it's like one of the most multicultural cities in the world. And that really opened my worldview as well. I mean, I'd never considered myself a racist person at all, but arriving here made me look at my upbringing and all of that completely differently. And it gave me the courage pretty much to sit down and write it. Plus, it's always freezing cold here, so there's nothing else to do except to write.
Well, you've only been there 5 years. I mean, your blood isn't thickened up yet.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I spoke to my parents yesterday. They're still in South Africa, and I said to them, my God, it's so hot today. I'm dying of heat. And they said, well, what temperature is it? And I said, well, 12 degrees Celsius. And they just, like, shook their heads at me. They were like, what is wrong with you? But, I mean, it is, you know. Unless it's minus 30 degrees Celsius, yeah, it's not really that cold. So I've gotten used to it. But in the beginning, it took some getting used to.
Sure, sure. Now, you were 15 years old when apartheid ended. Is that correct?
Yeah, 15, 16, yeah. Round about then. Yeah. A bit young. I was a bit older because I was 16 years old when the first black children were allowed into our schools. Mm-hmm. And that was before apartheid ended. So I was like, I think I was 18 when apartheid ended. Yeah.
Okay. I know it was a great relief to probably pretty much the world when it finally decided to take a dump and get out of there.
Yeah, you know, it was funny because it was a relief to the world, but like to most South Africans, they thought the world was about to end. I mean, mm-hmm. South Africans were stockpiling food. They were, you know, because they thought this is it. There's going to be a civil war. Mandela is going to galvanize people to now come after the whites in revenge. They were behind locked doors and, you know, and then they were waiting for this thing to happen. It was like the millennium, you know, everybody was expecting mm-hmm. computers to crash and everything, and then it just transitioned without all of that. So, yeah.
Well, that was a good thing.
Yeah. Well, and I really liked also that you introduce, tell us a little bit about Mag. I think it's Maggie, right, and her husband?
Right.
Tell us a little bit about them. They're very special to this storyline.
Right, so the character of Maggie and the Afrikaner character of Wilhelmina, they were both anti-apartheid activists, and they were extremely important to the story because they were sort of composites of the anti-apartheid activists who were active in South Africa at that time. And in doing research, I mean, I had to do a lot of research for this book because even though I grew up in South Africa, there was so much censorship of the press that most South Africans didn't really know what the heck was going on. And doing the research, I discovered that there was this group of people that, you know, even though it put their lives in danger, they were fighting apartheid. It was like their equivalent of the Underground Railroad. And most of them were actually Jewish people, which I discovered after the fact, Jewish lawyers, doctors, things like that. So I wanted to show that even though there was this, you know, dysfunctional society with these draconian laws that were just cruel and hideous, there were also people in South Africa who were fighting against it. Not enough people, but there were a few of them. And that's what Maggie was. You know, she was this anti-apartheid activist. And so she was trying to help black people, and she was trying to help the ANC in terms of ending apartheid. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want this book to be one of these white savior narratives, you know, mm-hmm. which I think happens in a lot of books where there's black and white people. I didn't want white people to be saving black people.
Right.
Even though Maggie has like really, really good intentions, and even though she's, you know, trying to help Beauty in terms of finding her daughter, a lot of the time she's trying so much to control the narrative. She's trying so much to control the outcome that she doesn't end up actually helping. So she has these really good intentions, and in some ways she does help. But I think as white people, a lot of the time we come into these situations and we think we can save people, or we think we can change things through our way of doing things, and that isn't always the right way to approach these situations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think you're probably mm-hmm. right. Not having ever been in a situation such as apartheid or anything close to it, actually. I always found it amazing that people actually lived through that and didn't wind up hating everybody after it. You know, because
well, that to me was fascinating. I mean, that Nelson Mandela came out of all of that, that he wasn't bitter, and that from the moment he was let out of prison, he spoke about reconciliation and he spoke about nation building as opposed to, you know, we're going to make you people pay. And that to me was also one of the most amazing things about my black caregiver as a child, Eunice. I mean, she turned 95 in May, and she has never expressed any bitterness about it. She, when I was a child, she never expressed bitterness about it then. She just loved me unconditionally. And to me, that was just amazing. My whole life, that's fascinated me, how someone who was looking after the children of the oppressor, and yet she could love us so unconditionally.
Yeah.
Well, I think you show through Robin's eyes, I guess, that racism is somewhat taught. And so she has perceptions because it's what she learned at home.
Right.
But she begins to learn that, you know, it's okay if they eat off of the same dishes. You know, it's okay if they cook with the same pots. And she slowly, you have her slowly kind of unlearning, or at least seeing another side where she begins to question what she had just taken for granted. And I really, you know, I, again, as a reader too, I really liked that in this 9-year-old who becomes 10 in the 1 year, she goes through so much growth.
Yeah.
In a character, you know.
and for her, it's love that does that to her. And it's the mm-hmm. same for me as a child. You know, it's virtually impossible to love someone and see them suffering and being subjected to this terrible treatment and not make it sort of open your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the catalyst for Robin, and that was the catalyst for me. As an author, it was challenging in terms of Robin's narrative, because in some instances I wanted her to be completely naive as a child and just see the world through a child's lens and through her eyes without being able to judge it. But in other instances, I wanted her to have an adult perception and to be able to look back and to be able to say, well, this was really messed up. So I chose this dual narrative for her, where she's actually an adult telling her life story, and in some instances it's through the eyes of a child, and sometimes it's more a mature narrative. And I think that's always a challenge for a writer, you know, looking at the point of view, looking at how you're going to explain this character's experience.
Richard and Jim, last week we had a really interesting, you all had a really interesting conversation near the end of the show about the use of sensitivity readers.
Correct.
And as I was reading this book, I kind of thought about last week's conversation, and it seemed like this would be the kind of book a sensitivity reader might be invited to read. Did you use sensitivity readers? You did. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was so nervous when I started writing this book, because as a white woman who has white privilege, who grew up benefiting from apartheid, I knew that I really was not equipped to write from a black woman's perspective. Even though I'd spent years in Soweto working with black women who shared the experience with me, it still wasn't my experience. So I was very nervous to write Beauty's perspective. So while I was doing the research, I consulted a lot of sensitivity readers. I consulted cultural experts and professors at South African universities. You know, it was really important to me that I approached this respectfully and that I did this character justice. And I think that's the most important thing when you're approaching writing a person of color, someone who's not, you know, your own perspective. I think approaching it with respect and not trying to portray this character as some kind of stereotype, or not using them to further, you know, whatever agenda you have. And I've spoken to many people of color who've read the book, and some didn't like the way I did it, and some loved the way I did it. So even now, after consulting sensitivity readers, even now, I don't know if I had a right to write this character. I honestly don't know, but I still also believe that if we as white people put ourselves in the shoes of people of color, and if we extend that empathy and we try and imagine an experience that's so vastly different to ourselves, I think the world would be a much better place. You know, so whether I had the right to do it, I honestly don't know, but I tried very much to do it in the best possible way I could.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, you're always going to have detractors, whether it's blacks reading it and don't like it or whites reading it and don't like it. I think you have to write and write beyond that. You know, your story is your story, and I don't think anybody really has to write to tell you whether you can or cannot write it or whether you have the right to write it. That's my opinion.
And you know what? I think it's just important to listen. I think, you know, you have writers like Lionel Shriver who goes to, you know, conferences and puts on a sombrero and is really disrespectful and says that she has the right to write whatever the hell she wants and to hell with other people's feelings. Mm-hmm. And that I don't agree with. So I think it's important to listen to people of color when they talk about appropriation.
Sure.
And that's what I tried to do. And I think, you know, just approaching it in the right way, I think that goes a long way to doing justice to a character.
I think you're right, and I'm going to cut you off right there. We're going to go do a real quick commercial, and then we'll be back to you in just a few seconds. So hang on, don't go away, and we'll be back to you in just a few. Hello. Imagine deep blue skies, majestic mountains, and acres of lush green orange trees in a tranquil country setting. Sound like a perfect vacation spot? It is. For your dog. That's right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Whether you are going away for a one-night or two-night getaway or an extended vacation, All Dogs Rule is the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. When your dog returns home, you'll have to ask, whose vacation was better? Yours?
It was definitely the dog.
The dog. So check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call, 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you. Russ Avison will thank you, and Karen will thank you,
and we will thank you.
Hell, I'll even thank you.
We'll even thank you.
So, All Dogs Rule, 805-524-1100.
You know, one of these days I'm going to say the porch pooch and just see what you do.
I know, huh? this is LA Talk Radio. You are listening to The Writer's Block. If you are just joining us, we have on the air with us this evening, Bianca Murray, a writer of a book called A Hum If You Don't Know the Words. And, of course, Bobby Jean is with us as well. And it is now 7:30. And if you want to call in and talk to Bianca, the number in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. Bianca, do you mind if we kind of switch gears a little bit?
Not at all.
Oh, good. Okay. I heard a rumor that you actually started writing this book as an exercise in your creative writing class. Is that pretty much being true?
Yeah, I did.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. So that is, you did do that.
Yes, I did. I was taking a creative writing class through the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd always written my whole life, but I'd never properly studied writing. So that's why I went and did the course. And I started writing the book while I was doing my class.
Mm-hmm. How did you find it writing your first novel in very small print and 420-some pages? Holy crap. I mean, I wear glasses, but I had to get big ones to read the print on this book.
But it read so fast.
It did. It you screamed through it, but still.
Yeah, you know what? I am so wordy, and that's my biggest challenge as a writer. I mean, I'm just finished polishing up my second book to submit to the publisher. And in the editing phase, I took out 40,000 words from this manuscript because it's just so ridiculously long. And, you know, I know writers who sit down and it takes them a day to write two paragraphs, but when those two paragraphs are written, they're absolutely perfect and there's no spare words.
Right.
And for me, I'm just like, I don't know if you've ever seen that gif of Kermit the Frog typing like a lunatic.
Right.
And that's me, and I just throw it as like an emotional vomit on the page and it's all there, and then afterwards I've got to clean it up, you know? for the mop.
There's a visual for you.
Yeah. There's a visual,
Emotional vomit.
Now I know who to reach out to when I'm coming up short on word count, because she's got plenty of extra words I can borrow.
Yeah, just call Bianca and say, Bianca, can I borrow some of your paragraphs?
Borrow a couple of words from you, please.
Yeah, my husband was very helpful. He was like, just take out every third word. I probably would have won all kinds of literary awards because it would be considered very avant-garde.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the longest word in the English language is I and B.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at a sentence, or you look at a book like, I can't even think of the name of it right now, but the word I is used a lot, and people don't even realize it.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So, at any rate.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, moving on, we have a question we like to ask our authors. And let's see, whose turn is it tonight? Richard, I think it's your turn to ask the question.
The question. You're testing to see if I pay attention over here is what you're doing.
I am, actually.
Okay, Bianca. So, the question is, do you ever suffer from writer's block? And if you do, what do you do to get past it?
I have never suffered from writer's block. I suffer from like writer's diarrhea, and there is another fabulous visual image. I have too many ideas, and the problem is when I'm writing one book, then I start to realize the limitations of that book, and it's not turning out to be this amazing, you know, creation that I envisaged. And then I start writing the next book because I tell myself that will be the amazing creation that I wanted it to be.
Right.
So for me, it's not like battling with ideas. It's trying to temper down the ideas and focus on one thing at a time.
Thank you for doing that, because I thought I was the only one who didn't. When they asked that question, that I don't get it.
No, actually, Craig Johnson doesn't either.
So there.
Who someone else, Bobby Jean, that said, no, I don't get it, because it doesn't exist.
Yes, and I can see his face clear as day, and I'll have to get back. It's not Chuck Walsh, but... I'll have to do a little research on that, because we have had a couple people say that.
Yeah.
And we've also had people call it more like writer's pause.
Yeah,
which
that's
also
me.
Thought
I have writer's
was a
pause,
good,
yeah.
You know, really just trying to get your thoughts back.
However, I like Bianca's explanation, writer's diarrhea.
We're going to use
that. I know.
We have now vomit on the page and writer's diarrhea.
I already made a note of that.
Writer's diarrhea and vomit on the page.
I think writer's block for some authors comes from having too much success, and then suddenly it scares them because they feel like the next thing's never going to measure up. Luckily, I haven't had that much success. So we'll talk again if I ever have that
we'll
much success.
Talk after this,
now,
we'll talk after this book hits the New York Times number one bestselling list.
Yeah.
When that happens, then we'll talk about writer's block.
Because we have had New York Times bestselling authors on this program. Believe it or not, we have.
I can believe it.
We even had a Pulitzer Prize winning author on this show.
You know, I could see where you would reach a point where you get writers, I don't care anymore, because you've had that success. And
exactly.
You've got your money and you don't have to get after it. But for those of us still getting that way, we don't have time for that.
Now, do they have,
I mean,
here in the United States, which is actually your southern neighbor, and you know, or actually Toronto, we call America Light. Do you guys
Canada's underwear?
Do you guys have this? You know, it's every writer's dream here in the States to write the great American novel. Is it every writer's dream in Canada to write the great Canadian novel?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Like the people who've grown up in Canada. I mean, Canada has the Giller Prize every year, and that's for the great Canadian novel. And it's extremely, extremely prestigious and very serious. And these are very serious novels that are groundbreaking, etc. You know, I became Canadian last year. I have dual Canadian and South African citizenship. So I would never presume to write a Canadian novel. For me, it was my dream to write the great South African novel. You know, and I think that's true for any writer who's grown up in a country and is sort of saturated in the country's history, etc.
So this is not your day job. Your day job is something totally different, correct?
Well, I still run a corporate training company in South Africa, which I do from Toronto. And it's great because it doesn't require that much involvement from my part. I've set it up that it sort of runs itself, and it's a passive income, which is great because that's what you need as a writer.
Right.
So I'm able to spend, you know, most of my time writing. That's probably why, how many of you don't know the words, took me almost 3 years to write, because there was no deadline, and I was like, la, 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 write when I feel like it. And whereas the second book, I mean, I sold that to my publisher based on a synopsis of 3 chapters, and then I got sort of 7 months to write that book, and suddenly I learned, Stephen
Deadlines.
King's philosophy of sitting down at 9 a.m. and finishing at 5 p.m. and working to a deadline. So I was much more diligent with the second novel than I was with the first.
Ah, so that was what I was going to ask you next. Your daily process for writing, can you kind of go there with us a little bit? I mean, you obviously get up in the morning, but you don't sit right down at the computer and start writing, do you?
Yeah. You know what? There's some days that I get up and immediately I sit down and I start writing. There's some days that at 4 o'clock I sort of look up and I'm still in my pajamas. Because I've just been writing all day, and then there's other days where I need to just remove myself from it and I think about it. So in terms of process, I'm not someone who has the set routine, but something that has been in my process since the first book is that I belong to a writer's group, these amazing women writers, and so every single chapter that I write, when I finish it, it goes out to them for critique, and I critique their work in return. And then I keep revising the draft as I get their feedback. So I'm not someone like Stephen King who sits down, writes the whole first draft, and there you go. You know, for me, it's a constant work in progress. And as I get the critique, I edit accordingly, and it sort of changes the way that the manuscript moves forward. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, has been an extremely helpful process.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How many publishers looked at the book before, I guess, Putnam published it, right? I know.
Right. Yeah, the first draft of the novel spanned 4 decades. And I mean, the finished draft now that you read spans 1 year and 3 months.
Right.
So about 100 publishers turned the novel down in the space of 1 year. And with each lot of rejections I got, I reworked the manuscript. I rewrote it. I polished it. The feedback was that they liked it, but that I'd been way too ambitious in terms of trying to cover 4 decades. And they felt that I should pick one period of time and focus on that, which is how in the millionth rewrite of the book, I decided to focus on Robin's childhood. And it was then that we finally got an acceptance on the book. But it's so difficult to have those 100 rejections and to just keep going and to just keep telling yourself it's going to happen and not to give up. And I refused to give up on the story because it was so important to me. And although this was my first book published, it was the third book I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first two were widely rejected by everyone and I gave up on them. But this book, I refused to give up on this book.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought now to go back and do some work on your first two?
They're so crap. That's really bad.
Are they? Wait a minute. Are they writer's diarrhea?
Yeah. You know, they're those Terry Pratchett spoofs I was talking about. They're just really bad, and there's a reason why they were rejected. And I see that now. You know, and that's why as a writer you need time between writing something and sending it out. You need time to be able to look at it and view it objectively.
Right.
So I don't think I'll go back to them, but I definitely learned from it. Like no work that you work on is completely wasted, because you know you learn with every book you learn.
Sure. I mean, by the time you get to your 10th book or 12th book, you've pretty much got it down pat.
I hope so. I really hope so. I'll let you know.
What's the second book? What's the second book about?
So
without giving anything away. Just
okay,
a basic story.
I won't
story.
Get too much away. The second book is called If You Want to Make God Laugh. And again, another wordy title. And someone pointed out to me another 7 words in the title, which I didn't at all intend. This book as well is based in South Africa, completely different characters, but it starts at the end of apartheid. So it starts when Nelson Mandela becomes president. And the backdrop to the story is you know, the South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy. It looks at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that happened in South Africa after apartheid. And it looks at the beginning of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And that's all the historical backdrop. And then I have three female characters. You know, I never mean to write feminist novels, but somehow that's what happens. I just love kick-ass female characters. And that's what happens in this book. And it tells their three separate stories until, you know, their stories converge. And there's two white characters and one black female character again. And again, I've had to consult sensitivity readers because she's not Xhosa like the first book, like Beauty. She's Zulu, which has all different cultural changes and connotations. So again, it's been challenging writing three characters rather than two. So again, you learn through the whole process.
Sure. What are you reading right now? What do you like to read?
I read pretty much everything. I mean, what am I reading now? Oh, I'm actually reading a psychological thriller at the moment, because I think that after my second book comes out, I'm going to completely change genres. I think I'm going to head for psychological thrillers, because I feel like after this book, I've said everything of value that I need to say about the world, about racism, about homophobia and prejudice and grief. And I think I want to have a bit of fun with some serial killers. I mean, don't
all right, I want a copy of that book.
Oh, bless you, Bianca. Like, bless you.
That's a good title.
Fun with serial killers.
Serial killers.
I've got your first title.
I think I was putting
it in.
Oh,
you hear that? Richard has your first title.
I've got your first title. Serial killers are people too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, it's a change. And I think as a writer, it's not always a bad thing to challenge yourself, change genres, mix it up a bit. And that's something that I want to do. So at the moment, that's what I'm reading a lot of. But in general, I love literary fiction. There's been amazing books that have come out in the last year. I don't know if you guys read The Immortalist by Chloe Benjamin.
No.
That made the New York Times bestseller list in January from when it came out. It's her second book, and she's only like 28 years old, which is, I mean, that just fascinates me because I'm 42 now, and my first book only just came out. And that's an amazing book. And I'm just sort of mixing it up at the moment.
Well, I was 58, so you beat me by, you know, a couple years.
Well, there we go. I'm a spring chicken in comparison. You
well,
see?
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
That was 46. I'm in between you two somewhere.
Yeah. So where can our listeners reach you, Bianca Murray?
Well, I am on all social media. You know, the amazing thing about being a writer today is that you get to interact with your audience, which is something that, like, 10 years ago didn't happen,
right.
or 20 years ago it didn't happen. You know, I think readers had to write a letter to the publisher, got forwarded to the writer. But now, you know, I'm on Facebook. I have an author page under Bianca Murray. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I do book club appearances in person if I can, and if not, on Skype. And every day I hear from readers, which is just amazing. You know, just to hear that your stories touch someone or they really appreciate it in some way. So I, you know, in any way it's possible to reach an order, an author, my readers can reach me. They can send homing pigeons, smoke signals, underwear in the mail. I'm available.
Oh, no. That's way too much information.
Remember, it has to clear customs if it's
That's the best thing I've ever received from a reader is a very rare collection of Elvis recordings, because he was a huge Elvis fan, and because of Elvis the Parrot and Edith being a fan of Elvis, he sent me this amazing recording, which was just touched me so much. It was just so beautiful to have a reader reach out with something like that, so special.
Well, it sounds nice. I mean, I've never been an Elvis fan, but hey. You know, there's got to be something to. Oh, Richard's over here giving me the eye.
Oh, boy.
The stink eye.
Well, Bianca,
thank you so much for spending your evening with us. It was absolute delight
having
you.
Me.
Oh, my gosh. You know, we've been pushing your book now for six months, and I'm just You know, we've been waiting for you to get here and waiting for you, and here you are. Yay!
Thank you so much. And I'm going to be on tour for the paperback launch in the U.S. from next week, and people can see the tour details on my website, biancamurray.com. Yeah, and I'm really looking forward
to it. Are you coming down to L.A.?
Unfortunately not. I was closer to LA for the hardcover release. Now I'm more going to be on the East Coast, but I'm hoping for the next book I'll be out in LA.
Okay.
So it would be lovely to see you.
Well, if you come down this direction, let us know and we'll troop over and see you.
I would absolutely love that.
Oh, us too. Trust me, because I would like to have an officially autographed Bianca Murray book.
Would you like me to do it on your underwear, on your shirt?
No. No, you can keep your underwear.
Gotcha.
Oh, wait, Bianca, you told me you were doing this interview naked.
I know. Well, we all are. You know, what can I say?
When does this become an R-rated show?
Well, it could be X-rated real fast.
Well, that's next door.
Bianca, thank you again for joining us, and it's just been a treat having you. And from all of us, and I'm sure that everybody will agree, it's been a delight having you. Bobby
Thank
Jane,
you.
Don't, you don't
Thank
need to say
you
anything.
So much.
Oh, you're absolutely so welcome. And let's talk again. Keep in touch. And when you're ready to release another book, have your publishers get a hold of the bookie, and we'll book you some more time.
I will. Thank you, Jim.
Oh, thank you. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
And that is Bianca Murray. And what a treat.
Oh, yeah. That was a good show.
Yeah. I'm impressed. I liked her. She's just a great gal. Oop, there we go. Okay. Bobby Jean.
Yes.
What do you got going? Anything exciting?
Well, I think we are going to be coming to Cowboy Festival.
Oh, my
All
God.
Right.
Are you serious?
Yes,
we're just finalizing where we'll stay, you know, because we have to do it in 2 days,
right.
The drive in 2 days.
Right.
So we're just kind of finalizing what day we would leave. And I think we would come in so that I could actually join you in the studio the Thursday night of that week.
Yay! Yay!
Yeah.
Well, here, let me give you a brief list of who's going to be at the Buckaroo Bookshop. Of course, Richard and myself will be there. Courtney Joyner will be there. J.R. Sanders, Eric Heisner, Al Bringus, Bob Brill, Dale Jackson, Johnny D. Boggs, Katie Ryan, Peter Shirico, and Michael Blake.
That's a good lineup.
It's a great lineup. So, and they've all committed. And the only one, Dale Jackson's only going to be there on Saturday. Everyone else is going to be there for both days. So, that's it. So we're looking forward to it. That's the 21st and 22nd?
Yes, it is.
Of April. So we're looking forward to, and really looking forward to seeing you, BJB.
Yeah, we will, yes, we'll come in a little earlier in the week so that we can take care of seeing some other folks that we didn't really get to see before we headed out of town.
I'm sure.
It's so crazy there in December. So we're kind of looking at, you know, trying to make the most of our, if we're going to make the trip, make the most of our time there. And we'd probably be at the festival just on Saturday.
Well, that's
so
fine.
That we can see some other folks out of the area on
the
Sunday.
Bookie.
But yeah, we I would love to be in the studio on that Thursday night.
Well,
and then be with y'all, you know, check in on you on Saturday.
Absolutely.
Some of our best musician friends are performing throughout the weekend. Kristen Harris will actually be appearing on March 11th on American Idol. And she's one of the gals performing throughout
right.
that weekend.
Right,
so
right.
It just makes sense for us to come on, you know, come on in.
Oh, hell, you might as well. Richard has a couple announcements he wants to make.
Yeah, apparently I've had an interesting week since I last showed up here. If you read Escaping Infinity as a book, it is going to be out as an audiobook in about a week. It's going through Amazon's quality check real quick, and it should be out. And reservations should be coming out in about a month, also as an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like I'm going to be traveling on Labor Day to Atlanta to attend Dragon Con 2018. And
Very cool.
Hopefully the book I'm working on right now will be out and ready, and you can get advanced copies at Dragon Con because it's not going to come out till mid-September.
There you go.
So I've got a few things happening.
And? The Last Lonely Trail?
Well, I was going to save that one for you.
No, go ahead.
All right. Well, Mr. Christina and I got together in the last few months, and we wrote a book called The Last Lonely Trail. And if you go on Amazon, you can find it and purchase it. It is out right now as a Kindle book, and it's also in print. So, yeah, grab a copy of that, and you can find out what happens when the two of us get together and plot evilly.
It's a great buddy story. It truly is. And it's kind of like Bobby Jean is about nasty is one of my books. It's lots of bloodshed but there's lots of humor in it too.
And creative ways to kill people.
And creative ways to kill off people. Mm. So we got good at it. Okay, we're gonna have to sign off for tonight. This is another Thursday. We of course have shot right in the butt. Bianca, if you're still listening, thank you again for joining us. It was a wonderful having you on the show. Bobby Jean, as always, I'm glad we got this Skype thing fixed up. You sound like you're sitting in the studio with us.
I feel like I'm right there with you.
Well, as you should, because we feel that you are, and we would rather have you here, but you're not, so you can't. Richard, always a pleasure.
It's been fun.
It has been fun.
See you next week.
You will. And for Bobby Jean and Richard and myself, this is, of course, LA Talk Radio. You are listening to The Writer's Block, and we are out of here.
In the jungle.